So I want you to just imagine for a second a planet.
Okay, a planet.
Yeah, a planet in orbit around some distant star, right? It's
Yeah.
just moving along, tracing its normal elliptical path.
Right, doing planet thing.
Exactly.
Wow.
But now imagine that because of some gravitational pull, I don't know, a rogue asteroid or something, its orbit suddenly becomes unstable.
Okay.
It wobbles, it goes totally off its regular path, and then eventually it just crashes into a nearby moon.
Total destruction.
Right. But ask yourself this. Did that planet do something wrong?
Well, I mean, no.
Right. Did it fail? The answer is obviously no. I mean, it's just physics playing out.
Exactly. It didn't make a mistake. It just suffered the consequences of natural laws, gravity doing its thing.
Exactly. But now hold that image in your head and let's just totally switch scenes. Imagine a cheetah sprinting across the savanna.
Oh, quite the pivot.
Yeah, bear with me. So it's locking in on its prey, but suddenly its ocular muscles, like the muscles controlling its eyes, they just fail to contract properly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Its vision blurs. It misses the catch. Did those ocular muscles do something wrong? Did they fail?
Well, yeah. I mean, suddenly the instinct to say yes is just overwhelming.
Right. It feels totally different. And that instinct, that urge to say the cheetah's eyes are malfunctioning, that is the entire focus of our deep dive today.
It really is the ultimate question in biology, isn't it?
It is. And we are jumping into a seriously rigorous, honestly kind of mind-bending paper by Xavier E. Barangaren today.
Yeah, organizational accounts of malfunction, the dual order approach, and the normative field alternative. It's quite a title.
It's a mouthful, but our mission here is to unpack how living things actually generate their own internal rules and like what it actually
Yeah.
means, both biologically and philosophically, when those rules are broken.
Because it really is the absolute core of the biological mystery. Scientists and philosophers have been wrestling with this for centuries, you know?
Right, because physically, what's the difference between the planet and the cheetah?
Exactly. If you look really closely at the cheetah's muscles at a microscopic level, what do you see? You just see actin and myosin filaments sliding past each other.
Just chemicals doing chemical things.
Yeah, calcium ions flooding a cellular matrix. It's chemistry, it's physics. Fundamentally, it is no different than the rock crashing into the moon.
Wow. Yeah. When you put it like that.
But the moment we look at the whole cheetah, we apply this completely different language to the system. We make a normative judgment.
Right. We declare that the muscle is like supposed to do something.
Yes, and that it failed to do it. We would never say the planet failed to orbit, but we immediately say the muscle failed to contract.
And we take that concept for granted all the time, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. Every
Yeah.
single day.
Like every time you say to a friend, my metabolism is running really slow today, or you look at a house plant, you're like, oh, its roots aren't taking up enough water.
You're making a profound normative judgment right there.
Yeah. You are stating that there is a standard, a biological norm that's being violated. But finding out where that norm actually comes from, like who set the standard and how we measure it, is shockingly hard.
It is. Because if there's no room for error, if there's no possibility of failure, you aren't really describing biology anymore.
What do you mean?
Well, you're just describing a sequence of physical events, like a snow crystal melting into water.
Oh, right.
A snowflake isn't malfunctioning when it melts, it's just melting. There's no rule saying it shouldn't.
Right, so we actually need failure to define life.
Exactly. Without a rigorous definition of what a malfunction is, the whole concept of functioning adds zero explanatory power to our understanding of life.
Which is wild to think about.
Right, and this is why Barangaren's paper focuses so heavily on what's called the organizational approach to biological function.
Because it argues that organisms generate these norms from within themselves, right? Through their own architecture.
Exactly. The goal of this paper is to show why older theories fail to explain this and how a really popular modern theory tries to solve it, but kind of falls into this trap of binary thinking.
Like an on-off switch.
Right. And then finally, how we can map out a continuous fluid alternative called the normative field.
Okay, I want to get to the normative field because it's fascinating. But before we get into the weeds of how an organism builds its own rules, let's talk about the old paradigms.
Yeah, we have to clear the brush first.
Right. So the paper outlines two classic frameworks that have pretty much dominated this conversation for decades, the biostatistical approach and the etiological or evolutionary approach.
Right, the two heavyweights.
Let's start with the biostatistical model. Christopher Bourse is the big name here, right?
Yeah, Bourse really championed this one.
And on the surface, it seems so incredibly straightforward. It basically says normal function is just statistical normality within a reference class.
It's the bedrock of so much modern medical philosophy, honestly.
Like if a doctor wants to know if you're healthy.
Exactly. Under this framework, if you want to know if a human kidney is functioning, you just compile a massive data set of kidneys from people of the same age, the same sex, and general demographic.
Just a giant spreadsheet of kidney data.
Basically. You establish a bell curve of filtration rates. And if a specific patient's kidney deviates significantly from that statistical mean, like if it drops into the bottom percentile, you just classify it as a malfunction.
So it defines the biological norm entirely through just statistical popularity.
Literally just how common it is.
Which, okay, that works perfectly fine if you were an insurance actuary, right?
Oh, sure.
But the paper points out that it falls apart almost immediately when you look at edge cases.
It really does.
Like, think about an entirely new, highly beneficial mutation. Let's say an organism develops a brand new enzyme that lets it digest some toxic plastic in its environment.
A great advantage.
Right. But statistically, that enzyme is a massive anomaly. It deviates entirely from the population average because literally no one else has it yet.
Exactly. And so under the biostatistical model, this incredibly helpful, totally life-saving new trait would technically have to be classified as abnormal.
Like a malfunction. Simply because it's rare.
That is the glaring flaw right there. It completely fails to account for novelty or adaptation.
Which is like the main driver of biology.
Right. Furthermore, it assumes you always have this robust population to draw your reference from.
Oh, wait. What if you don't?
Exactly. What if a species is reduced to a single surviving member? How do you define a malfunction in, like, the last living Pinta Island tortoise?
Oh, wow. Because there's no one to compare it to.
Right. You have no statistically significant population to compare its organs against. You end up in this philosophical dead end where health is literally just a popularity contest among traits.
Okay. Yeah. So the spreadsheet method completely fails.
Oh, boy.
Which means we have to turn to the other classic heavyweight, the etiological approach.
The evolutionary perspective.
Right. Thinkers like Larry Wright and Ruth Millikan. And this one says, a biological part functions properly when it does what evolution selected it to do.
It makes a lot of intuitive sense to us.
It really does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the heart was selected over millions of years because pumping blood increased the fitness of our ancestors. Therefore, pumping blood is its proper function.
Right. And if it doesn't pump blood, it's malfunctioning.
It appeals so deeply to our post-Darwinian brains.
It does, but it suffers from this paralyzing circularity.
How so?
Well, you end up assuming the function in order to explain why it was selected in the first place. And then you define the function by the fact that it was selected. It just chases its own tail.
Ah, okay. I see that.
And beyond that circularity, the etiological approach shares the exact same weakness as the biostatistical approach when it comes to brand new traits.
Oh, right. The plastic eating enzyme.
Exactly. When that enzyme first appears, it hasn't been subjected to generational selection yet. It has zero evolutionary history.
So evolution hasn't selected it for anything yet?
Right. Therefore, according to this theory, that enzyme currently has absolutely no biological function.
Even as it is actively digesting plastic and literally saving the organism from starving to death in real time.
Exactly. It's absurd.
So both of these models suffer from what the text calls the problem of epiphenomenalism.
Yes. Big word, but crucial concept.
Basically meaning they aren't looking at what the organism is actually doing right now.
Right. Evolutionary history and statistical spreadsheets, they are just historical or comparative abstractions.
Yeah, if a doctor is treating your failing liver in the ER, the evolutionary history of the mammalian liver across the Pleistocene epoch is not what is making you sick.
The doctor does not care about the Pleistocene.
No. The actual physical immediate organization of your cells in that exact moment is all that matters.
Because the causal activity happening in your physical body at this exact second is the only thing determining if you survive or die.
Right.
A normative function has to provide causally relevant explanatory value to the current functioning of the organism.
And this realization is what birthed the organizational approach, right?
Exactly. This school of thought just throws the evolutionary history books out the window. It tosses the statistical spreadsheets.
Good riddance.
It demands that we look at the system itself right now in the present moment. And to do that, it leans heavily on the physics of dissipative structures.
Okay, dissipative structures. I want to draw a line here between conservative structures and dissipative structures.
Good idea.
Because a rock, a diamond, a wooden table, these are conservative. They're held together by stable chemical bonds.
They just sit there.
Right, they will sit there indefinitely. And unless you actively apply outside energy to break them apart, like taking a hammer to a table.
Right.
But a dissipative structure is different. It requires a constant, relentless flow of external energy and matter just to maintain its shape.
Like a vortex.
Yes. The classic example is a vortex in a draining bathtub. The shape of the vortex only exists because water is continually rushing through it.
And if you plug the drain and stop the flow,
the vortex dissipates. It just vanishes.
Right. So a biological organism is basically a magnificently complex dissipative structure.
We are just very fancy whirlpools.
Exactly. We require an unbroken inflow of food, oxygen, energy, alongside a continuous outflow of waste just to keep our physical form from collapsing into thermodynamic equilibrium.
And in biology, thermodynamic equilibrium is really just a polite clinical term for death.
That is exactly what it is, dust to dust. But organisms possess two critical features that elevate them way above a simple bathtub vortex.
And those are constraint closure and recursive self-maintenance.
Right. This is where we cross the line from pure physics into actual biology.
Because, wait, if a tornado is a dissipative structure, which it is, right, it needs wind and temperature gradients to maintain its funnel shape.
Definitely.
But can a tornado malfunction?
Well, no, because a tornado doesn't build a wall around itself to manage the wind.
Oh, right.
It is entirely at the mercy of external weather patterns. It just exists while the conditions are right.
Right. So what does a cell do differently?
A biological cell actually produces its own membrane.
Oh, okay. And that membrane acts as a physical constraint. It selectively controls the intake of nutrients. Those nutrients then fuel the internal metabolism. And that metabolism produces the lipids required to repair and maintain the membrane. Ah, so it builds the thing that feeds the thing that builds the thing.
That circular loop is constraint closure. The parts of the system are produced by the system, and those exact same parts constrain the system to ensure the continuous production of themselves.
It's a radical form of physical autonomy.
It really is. And this recursive loop creates what philosophers call a dynamic presupposition.
Dynamic presupposition. Okay, break that down for me.
It just means each component of the organism dynamically expects the other components to do their jobs.
Like they're relying on each other.
Yeah. The internal metabolism presupposes that the membrane will keep toxins out and let glucose in. And the membrane presupposes that the metabolism will generate the ATP energy needed to keep its ion pumps running.
So if the membrane suddenly becomes too permeable and it lets a lethal toxin flood the cell, it has violated the dynamic presupposition of the metabolism.
Exactly.
It has failed the internal demands of the system. It is malfunctioning.
Yes. And notice, we didn't need to consult a statistical average to know that.
Right.
And we didn't need to map the evolutionary lineage of the cell. We just observed the immediate self-maintaining loop breaking down in real time.
So the norm, the actual rule governing what the membrane should do, emerges entirely from the internal architecture of the system itself.
That is what they call a natural or intrinsic function. It arises from the organism's own capacity to couple with its environment.
Contrast this with like an artificial function, like a coffee maker.
Right. A coffee maker doesn't recursively build its own heating element.
Sadly, no. We have to buy parts.
Exactly. Its function to brew coffee was imposed on it entirely from the outside by a human engineer.
So if my coffee maker breaks, it loses its functional attribution only because I, the external observer, am frustrated that I'm not getting my caffeine.
Yes. The machine itself possesses zero intrinsic drive to maintain its own existence. It doesn't care if it's broken.
Which means only a self-maintaining organization can truly malfunction in a biological sense.
You've hit the nail on the head.
But establishing that organization is the key, is really just the starting point of this paper. Because even within this organizational framework, there is a fierce debate about exactly how to map out these failures.
Oh, academic philosophy is never that simple.
Never. Which leads us to the reigning heavyweight champion within this specific niche, the SMM approach.
Saburito, Moreno, and Mossio. Those are the authors of SMM. And they formulated this theory, which is widely considered the standard organizational account of malfunction.
Right.
And they recognized a fundamental truth. Biological systems are not just a single simple loop of metabolism.
Like a single-celled bacteria might be relatively straightforward, but a human mammal is this incredibly complex hierarchy of systems.
Exactly. So to manage this complexity, SMM proposed what they called the dual order approach. They split the organism into two distinct levels of operation.
Okay, let's walk through these two levels. The first level is the constitutive order.
Right.
This is your foundational metabolic network, just the basic chemical reactions keeping the baseline lights on.
And this order generates first-order norms.
So, like your basic resting metabolism dictating that you need a certain baseline level of oxygen and glucose just to keep your organs from dying, that's a first-order norm.
Exactly. But organisms don't live in static voids. We exist in chaotic, shifting environments. We have to adapt.
Right, the tiger jumps out of the bushes.
Yeah. So SMM introduces the second level, the regulatory order. These are the higher level mechanisms, the nervous system, the endocrine system, complex gene expression
And
network.
what do they do?
These systems issue commands that modulate that foundational constitutive network. They generate second order norms.
Okay, so if the basic metabolism is a car engine idling, the regulatory order is the driver pressing the gas pedal when they need to merge onto the highway.
That's a great analogy. The paper uses the concept of regimes of self-maintenance to explain how these two orders interact.
Regimes.
Yeah, your body sitting comfortably on the couch is one regime. Your body sprinting away from that tiger you mentioned is an entirely different regime, requiring a vastly different physiological setup.
Totally different blood flow, oxygen usage, everything.
Right. Under SMM's framework, a regulatory mechanism observes the environment and decides which regime the organism needs to be in.
And then it sends a command down to the first order to switch.
Exactly. It sends a second order command to the constitutive traits to adapt to the new regime. And this brings us to their highly specific definition of a malfunction.
Which is where things get controversial.
Very. According to SMM, a malfunction occurs if and only if a trait perfectly fits the first order norms of the current regime, but fails to obey the second order regulatory commands to switch to a new regime.
Okay, let's trace their primary example so the listener can really see how this logic flows. It involves the coronary artery.
A classic example.
Right, so imagine you are in that comfortable rest regime on the couch. Your autonomic nervous system is totally calm, your heart rate is low.
Baseline functioning.
Right, your coronary artery, the crucial vessel that supplies oxygenated blood directly to the heart muscle, is at a normal narrow diameter. It is perfectly fulfilling the first order norms of this resting regime.
It is matching the functional presuppositions of that exact moment.
But then a sudden stressor occurs, a loud noise, a perceived threat. Someone kicks in your front door.
Right. The autonomic nervous system, which is the second order regulator, instantly dumps adrenaline into your bloodstream.
It is demanding an immediate shift from the rest regime to the stress regime.
Exactly. The heart starts pounding furiously, preparing for fight or flight. It now requires a massive increase in blood flow.
But let's say this specific coronary artery has structural damage, like plaque buildup, maybe.
It fails to dilate.
Right. It remains narrow, completely incapable of delivering the sudden surge of blood that the pounding heart demands.
And there's your SMM malfunction. The regulatory mechanism ordered a regime shift. The constitutive trait, the artery, failed to modulate its activity to match the new dynamic presuppositions of the stress regime.
It was working fine in the first order, but it failed the second order command.
Exactly.
I have to say, honestly, that sounds incredibly intuitive. It perfectly maps onto how we naturally understand a stress-induced heart attack.
It does.
So where does Brannion find a flaw massive enough to write an entire paper dismantling it?
The flaw lies in the rigidity of the model.
The rigidity.
Yeah. Berendian argues that while SMM perfectly describes that one specific type of dramatic regulatory failure, it is vastly too narrow to encompass the messy reality of biology.
Okay.
He targets what he calls the problem of binary functionality.
The binary, like ones and zeros.
Exactly. SMM treats biological functions as all or nothing states. You are either perfectly maintaining the regime or you aren't.
Wait, really?
Yes. They explicitly argue that while the concept of malfunctioning can admit degrees like you can malfunction a little or a lot, the core state of functioning is just a binary switch. You're either functioning or you're not.
But biological reality doesn't operate on discrete switches. If I just stand up from the couch to walk to the kitchen, I'm not shifting into a full-blown stress regime, right?
Right.
But my heart rate still has to elevate slightly. my blood pressure adjusts continuously. It's a fluid gradient of adaptation, not a train switching from track A to track B.
And that continuous graded reality of living systems completely breaks the SMM model.
How so?
Let's return to your coronary artery example, but this time, let's remove the sudden stressor.
Okay, no one kicks in the door. I'm just watching TV.
Right. You were just sitting on the couch, permanently in the rest regime. But over the course of 10 years, that artery slowly hardens.
Plaque just slowly building up over time.
Exactly. It loses its elasticity. It begins to struggle to dilate properly, even for the minor fluctuations required during basic resting periods. Its capacity is in a state of slow, steady degradation.
Okay, wait. If there is no second-order regulator demanding a sudden shift to a new regime, how does SMM classify the hardening artery?
Under SMM's strict dual-order definition, that slowly failing artery cannot be classified as malfunctioning.
Are you serious? Because it hasn't failed a regime shift command yet.
Precisely.
That's absurd. A cardiologist would absolutely look at that hardening artery and diagnose a dysfunction,
right,
regardless of whether you are currently being chased by a tiger or watching television.
Any doctor would.
Yeah.
But SMM's definition structurally excludes a trait malfunctioning within its current regime. It absolutely requires an external regulatory trigger to define the failure.
Wow. That is a massive blind spot.
Oh, but the critique deepens when you examine the regulators themselves.
Okay, what happens when the second order system breaks?
Imagine the threat appears. Someone kicks the door in, but your autonomic nervous system is damaged. It fails to release the adrenaline.
So the stress regime is never triggered.
Right. The artery stays narrow, but only because it was never commanded to open.
Well, the nervous system has obviously failed there.
But think about SMM's rules. If SMM requires a higher order regulator to command a regime shift for a malfunction to occur.
Oh, no. You would need a third order regulator to tell the second order nervous system to shift, and the nervous system would have to fail that command.
You end up trapped in an infinite regression of regulators just to explain a simple biological failure.
Turtles all the way down.
Exactly. Barandiaran's core thesis against SMM is that it imposes this hierarchical military-style chain of command onto biology when real biology is actually a heterarchy.
A heterarchy, meaning no clear top-down boss.
Right. A tangled, messy web. In a real cell, metabolites, which are the basic fuel at the very bottom of the constitutive order, they can directly inhibit or activate the enzymes that regulate them.
So the bottom regulates the top.
Yeah. There is no clean dividing line between a constitutive process and a regulatory process.
Okay, so if we completely discard the clunky binary switches of SMM, we obviously need a new framework. One that embraces the continuous gradient-based reality of an organism.
Right, we need a better map.
A map that shows how an organism navigates survival moment by moment. And to build this, Barandiaran looks backwards to a concept from 1950s cybernetics.
Viability theory, developed by W. Ross Ashby.
Ashby. So viability is, at its core, basically just the capacity to stay alive, right?
Exactly. And Ashby proposed that we can mathematically map the existence of any living system by identifying its essential variables.
Essential variables. Give me some examples.
These are the critical metrics that must be maintained within specific bounds to prevent the organism from dissolving. Internal body temperature, blood oxygen saturation, hydration levels, cellular ATP concentration.
Okay, things you absolutely need to survive.
Right. Now imagine taking all of these essential variables and using them to construct a multidimensional phase space.
A phase space.
And this is what we call the viability space.
All right, I want to avoid getting bogged down in multidimensional geometry here. So let's try to visualize the implications of this space. It's basically a map of survival.
Yes.
And Barandiaran divides this map into three distinct regions. The first is the viable region.
This is the comfort zone.
Right. If your temperature, your oxygen, and your nutrient levels are securely within this region, and the external environment doesn't suddenly change, the organism will just remain alive indefinitely.
It is a state of robust stability, but, you know, organisms rarely get to just stay there.
Unfortunately.
The second region is the terminal region. This is the point of no return.
The doom zone.
Yeah. If the organism's state enters this mathematical space, irreversible disintegration has begun.
So even if you try to fix it, it's too late.
Exactly. No matter what interventions occur, no matter how much food you suddenly introduce or how drastically you alter the temperature, the cascading failure of the organism's constraint closure is unstoppable.
It's technically still alive for a brief window, but death is mathematically locked in.
Right. So you have the safe zone and the doom zone. But the entire drama of biology plays out in the space between them.
The precarious region.
Yes. This is where most organisms spend their entire lives.
The precarious region is like the defining state of biological autonomy, isn't it?
It really is. When an organism is in this space, it is alive, but the spontaneous, unguided tendency of the physical system is pulling it relentlessly toward the terminal region.
So if the organism simply does nothing, the laws of thermodynamics will drag it across the terminal boundary.
Which means the organism must take action. It must induce a parametric change in its relationship with the environment to alter its trajectory.
And this is where Barandiaran introduces his absolute masterstroke, the normative field.
The big concept of the paper.
Right. He defines it as the minimum constant parametric change required at any point in the precarious region to avoid disintegration.
To ground this in reality, because it sounds very abstract, Barandiaran uses a simplified metabolic model. He maps two essential variables.
Okay, let's break these down.
F, representing the amount of food available in the local environment, and A, representing the concentration of metabolites currently inside the organism's body, the energy reserves.
Okay, so F is food outside, A is energy inside. You can picture the organism's state as being basically fat, mean, or lean.
Right.
So if you are in the viable region, meaning you are fat, with a high concentration of internal metabolites and a steady supply of food around you, you are stable. You're fine.
But what happens when you become lean?
Right. Your internal metabolite concentration, A, begins to plummet. You enter the precarious region.
And the spontaneous physical tendency of your body is to just continue metabolizing whatever remaining reserves you have until A hits zero.
Which is the terminal boundary. You are literally starving.
Exactly. Now, the normative field provides a mathematical vector at your exact coordinate in that phase space.
Like an arrow pointing you where to go.
Yes. It acts like a compass needle, pointing away from the terminal boundary, dictating exactly how much you need to increase F, how much food you must consume, to pull your trajectory back toward the viable region.
And the phrase minimum constant change is so crucial here because it respects that fluid gradient nature of life we were talking about earlier.
Right, it's not a switch.
Because if I am mildly hungry, like I'm just barely slipping into the precarious region, the normative field doesn't demand that I instantaneously consume 10,000 calories.
That would be ridiculous.
It simply demands that I begin moving toward food and start consuming it at a rate that mathematically outpaces my internal energy drain.
But the closer you get to starvation,
the steeper and more urgent that vector becomes. The minimum constant change required to avoid death increases drastically.
The normative field is a continuous topography of survival. And this allows us to completely redefine biological function without resorting to SMM's binary switches.
Because a trait operates normatively, meaning it functions properly, if its action positively correlates with the vector of the normative field.
Exactly. If the field demands an increase in food intake to avoid starvation, and your behavioral system starts navigating you toward a food source, that behavioral system is functioning.
It is aligned with the geometry of survival.
It is so incredibly elegant.
It really is. And because we now have a continuous map rather than a binary switch, we finally have the vocabulary to describe the nuance of biological failure.
We don't just have working and broken anymore.
Right. Barandiaran outlines what he calls a threefold typology of dysfunction.
Let's reason through how a trait can actually fail against this normative field.
Okay, so if a trait positively correlates with the field, meaning it's going in the right direction, but it lacks the necessary power, that gives us the first category, right?
Subfunctional.
Subfunctional. The trait is moving the organism in the correct direction, but it's quantitatively failing to meet the minimum rate of change required.
Give me an example of that.
Think of temperature regulation. Let's say you are hiking in a scorching desert.
Okay, I'm sweating already. Your internal body temperature climbs into the precarious region. The normative field generates a vector. You must lower your internal temperature at a specific rate to avoid crossing the terminal boundary into heat stroke.
So my sweat glands activate.
Right. Sweating positively correlates with the normative field's demand. It is the correct response.
But let's say I'm severely dehydrated. My body attempts to sweat, but it can only manage like a faint glisten.
The evaporative cooling is technically happening, but the rate of cooling is vastly outpaced by the rate at which the desert sun is heating your body.
So I am still drifting toward the terminal region, just slightly slower than I would be if I wasn't sweating at all?
Precisely. Your sweat glands are operating subfunctionally. They are attempting to satisfy the norm, they are correlated with the current vector, but they fail the quantitative threshold.
The dysfunction is a matter of degree, not a failure of kind.
Exactly.
Okay, so if subfunctional is trying but failing, I imagine the next failure state is actively working against survival.
You'd be correct. Which brings us to the second category, malfunctional.
Malfunctional.
A true malfunction occurs when a trait's operation either negatively correlates with the normative field or operates entirely randomly, oblivious to the systemic demands.
Okay, return to the desert hike.
Your temperature is spiking dangerously. The normative field is screaming for a reduction in heat. But due to a severe neurological glitch induced by the extreme temperature, your muscular system begins to violently shiver.
Oh no, because shivering generates internal thermal energy.
Right. It is the precise opposite of what the normative field is demanding.
The shivering response actively accelerates the organism's trajectory toward the terminal region.
It is negatively correlated with the vector of survival.
Yeah.
This is a profound structural failure. It is an active violation of the dynamic presupposition of the organism's organization.
That is a terrifying scenario, but conceptually, it perfectly isolates the worst-case failure mode.
Right.
We have trying but failing, we have actively doing the wrong thing, which leaves the final category, non-functional.
Failing to act at all.
Right. This is a dysfunction by omission. You are overheating in the desert, your body temperature is critical, and your sweat glands simply do nothing.
They don't sweat, they don't shiver, they are utterly inert.
And because the normative field is explicitly demanding parametric change to avoid death, the absence of action is a direct violation of the norm.
Exactly. But there is a really important nuance to this third category that we have to clarify.
What's that?
A non-functioning trait is only dysfunctional if it is dynamically presupposed to be acting at that exact moment.
Oh, I see.
Like, if you are sitting comfortably in a climate-controlled room, perfectly centered in the viable region.
My sweat glands are doing nothing. They are non-functional.
But they're not dysfunctional because in the viable region, the normative field vector is zero. It requires no change.
The dynamic presupposition of this system is currently satisfied. The sweat glands are dormant, but they are not failing a normative demand.
Exactly. You get it.
This entire framework completely shifts how you view health and disease, honestly.
It really does.
Like, when you are ill, you aren't a machine with a broken gear. Your body is this wildly complex network of traits constantly trying to align with invisible shifting vectors of survival.
It's beautiful in a way.
Sometimes the system's just a little too slow. Sometimes the system gets confused and pulls in the wrong direction. And sometimes the system just stops responding entirely. It's a continuous spectrum of dynamic alignment.
It totally replaces that rigid mechanical view of life with a deeply fluid systemic understanding.
Right.
But, and this is a big, but as with any systemic theory, it introduces a significant practical challenge.
Oh, I bet. If everything is an interconnected web, diagnosing the exact point of failure becomes incredibly difficult.
Exactly. This is what Barandiaran tackles in the section on systemic backtracking for dysfunctional attribution.
Basically, biological detective work.
Yes. Let's say the entire organism is starving, meaning the internal metabolite level is plunging towards zero. How do we know who to blame?
Right. Is it because the cellular membrane's specific substrate uptake mechanism, let's just call it U, is broken and refusing to absorb food?
Or is U perfectly fine, but the organism's macrobehavioral system is broken, meaning the animal is just staring blankly at a wall instead of foraging for the food that U is waiting to absorb?
Wow, yeah. Both scenarios result in systemic starvation.
Because the organism is a recursively self-maintaining network, you cannot simply look at the final symptom to find the cause. You must trace the dependencies backward through the system.
And Barandiaran calls this iterative testing against local mechanistic limits and systemic presuppositions.
Let's walk through this systemic backtracking step by step. We see the organism starving. We hypothesize that the uptake mechanism, U, is to blame.
Okay, so we zoom in on U. We ask, is U operating as fast as the laws of physics and its own chemical structure allow?
Exactly. If there is abundant food surrounding the cell, but U is only absorbing it at a microscopic trickle, well, U becomes the prime suspect for the subfunctional behavior.
It's just too slow.
But biological traits are physical entities. They have saturation limits. They experience molecular friction. What if we analyze U and discover it is totally physically saturated?
Meaning, it is pumping molecules at its absolute theoretical maximum speed, but it's still not enough to satisfy the plunging metabolite levels.
Exactly. If you is doing its absolute physical best, it isn't malfunctioning. The failure must lie elsewhere in the web. We have to backtrack further.
Okay, let's take another path. We look at you, and it's barely pumping, but it isn't saturated.
Right.
We look closer and find a chemical inhibitor firmly blocking you's receptor site.
Ah, a blockage.
So you is failing to meet the normative demand, but it has a valid mechanistic excuse. It is being jammed. So we backtrack again.
We ask the system, where did this inhibitor come from and why is it here?
And maybe we discover that the organism's genetic code dynamically presupposes the presence of a specific supportive enzyme.
Mm.
Let's call it S.
Okay.
And S's sole job is to clear that exact inhibitor away from you. But when we look for S, it's missing. The gene failed to express it.
So the overarching systemic dysfunction is starvation. The immediate physical locus of the blockage is you.
But the ultimate dysfunctional attribution, the true biological blame, lands squarely on the missing enzyme S.
Exactly. You iteratively map the network of presuppositions until you locate the specific component that is failing its local normative demand without a valid mechanistic limitation.
That's brilliant. I see how that works for a straightforward chain of events. But the paper addresses a massive complication here, one that could honestly threaten the entire theory if it isn't handled correctly.
The compensation problem?
Yes, the compensation problem. Because biological systems are famously redundant and adaptable, what happens when a part breaks, but the body just patches the whole?
This is a classic conundrum in philosophy of biology.
Right, because if a specific component fails entirely, but another part of the system ramps up its activity to cover the deficit, the overall function of the system appears to be restored.
The organism's trajectory stops drifting toward the terminal region.
Right. So if the normative field is satisfied, does the original dysfunction just magically cease to exist? Can we no longer say the broken part is malfunctioning just because the organism figured out a temporary workaround?
It's a great question, because if the theory forces us to say a broken part is actually fine because of a workaround, doctors would laugh it out of the room.
Exactly. A broken part is a broken part. How does Brandian close this loophole?
He solves it by expanding the temporal horizon of the dynamic presupposition.
Okay, big words. What does that mean?
He argues that compensation almost universally exacts a cost on long-term viability. The organism's organization isn't just a snapshot of the present second. It is a trajectory extended across time.
Ah, okay.
He relies on two stark medical examples to prove this point. Let's start with renal failure.
Okay, so let's say a patient suffers severe trauma and loses the function of one entire kidney. The filtration of toxins from the blood drops dangerously.
Right. The system immediately enters the precarious region. But the human body is incredibly adaptive.
It is.
The remaining healthy kidney undergoes hypertrophy. It physically enlarges. It initiates a process of hyperfiltration, dramatically increasing the workload of its individual nephrons to maintain the overall renal clearance required by the body.
So if you take that patient's blood work a month later, the biostatistical output looks perfectly normal. The toxins are being cleared. The system appears totally viable.
It appears viable in the short term, but the dynamic presupposition of the human organism expects two kidneys to distribute that massive hemodynamic load.
Right.
Because of this structural compensation, the delicate glomerular capillaries in the single working kidney are forced to sustain a hydrostatic pressure they were never architecturally designed to withstand indefinitely.
Oh, wow. So they just wear out.
Over years, this relentless overexertion leads directly to glomerular sclerosis, which is scarring of the filtration tissue.
So the temporary fix is actually a slow motion failure.
Exactly. The compensation guarantees a severe future cost to systemic viability, because the long-term dynamic presupposition of the whole organism is broken by this forced adaptation, we can definitively point to the original damaged kidney and declare that organ is malfunctioning, regardless of the fact that the immediate blood test looks acceptable.
The same logic applies to his orthopedic example, too. Tearing an anterior cruciate ligament, the ACL, in the knee.
Ah, yes.
The ligament is gone. The joint loses its primary mechanical stabilizer.
Yet many people can still walk, and sometimes even run, after an ACL tear without surgical intervention.
Piece of compensation.
Right. The nervous system rapidly rewires the firing patterns of the surrounding musculature, primarily the quadriceps and hamstrings. These muscles involuntarily tense and co-contract to artificially brace the joint during movement.
So the macro function of walking is technically restored.
But muscles are designed to generate movement, not to act as passive, permanent tension bands.
Precisely. by forcing dynamic muscles to perform the job of a static ligament. You fundamentally alter the biomechanics of the entire joint.
The force distribution across the tibial plateau shifts,
which causes abnormal, highly concentrated shear stress on the meniscal cartilage.
And this accelerated, uneven wear and tear inevitably leads to early onset osteoarthritis,
permanently degrading the organism's mobility and plunging it back toward the precarious region down the line.
Right. The system presupposes the ligament doing the stabilizing so the muscles are free to do the moving.
Breaking that presupposition has a traceable long-term cost. Therefore, the ACL is malfunctioning, despite the muscular compensation.
It is deeply satisfying logic, isn't it?
It really is. It proves that biological norms are deeply rooted in the physical architecture of time.
Which naturally brings us to the final and undoubtedly the most philosophically demanding layer of Barandiaran's paper.
Oh boy.
We have spent this entire discussion building a robust operational model of malfunction based on organizational phase spaces and normative fields.
Right.
But we have avoided the ultimate metaphysical bedrock question.
We have to ask what these biological norms actually are, physically speaking.
Yes.
When the normative field dictates that the organism must alter its temperature to survive, where does that must come from? It isn't a fundamental force of physics like gravity or electromagnetism, right?
Right.
You can't isolate a norm in a particle accelerator.
Exactly. And this is where we see the starkest contrast between SMM's dual order approach and Barandiaran's normative field on a purely metaphysical level. And it stems from a deeply ingrained fear within the philosophy of science known as epiphenomenal anxiety.
Epiphenomenal anxiety. Okay, I'm feeling a bit of that right now, just hearing the phrase. Break that down for me.
Well, since the scientific revolution, we have been trained to believe in strict mechanical causality. Billiard ball A strikes billiard ball B, causing it to move.
Action and reaction.
Exactly. Philosophers of biology are terrified that if a biological norm isn't a physical, tangible entity actively pushing chemicals around like a billiard ball, then it doesn't actually exist.
Like it's just a ghost.
Right. If it's just an abstract concept, then biological function is an illusion, and we are back to just describing a complex, meaningless cascade of chemistry.
So SMM tried to solve this anxiety by physicalizing the norm.
Right.
They made the second order regulator,
mm-hmm.
the nervous system, the hormone cascade, the literal physical enforcer of the rule. They turned the norm into a tangible mechanism that issues commands to the lower order.
Exactly. They viewed norms as a conflict of efficient causes. The regulator physically forces the constitutive order to behave, but Barandiaran rejects this entirely.
Okay, so what is his alternative?
He argues that norms are absolutely not efficient causes. They don't push things. The normative field isn't a ghostly force field physically dragging the organism toward food.
Right.
Instead, he reaches back to Immanuel Kant to frame norms as transcendental conditions of possibility.
Okay, Immanuel Kant. Transcendental conditions of possibility. Let's walk through this very slowly. Because if a norm isn't a physical force, how does it exert control over a physical system?
First, we must strip away the mystical connotations of the word transcendental.
Right. It sounds a bit supernatural.
In Kantian philosophy, it simply refers to the structural preconditions that must be met for something to exist or be experienced in the first place. Barandiaran argues that normativity is subphenomenal.
Subphenomenal,
mm-hmm.
meaning it sits beneath the observable phenomenon itself.
Exactly. For a recursively self-maintaining dissipative structure, an organism to exist in front of you, for you to observe it alive in the here and now, it must have already continuously satisfied its normative descriptions. The fact that the organism hasn't dissolved into thermodynamic equilibrium is the proof that the norms are being met.
Wait, okay. So the norm isn't a force acting on the organism to keep it alive. The organism's ongoing existence is the physical manifestation of the norm being satisfied.
Exactly. Functions are explanatory without being mechanically causal.
That is a crucial distinction. The organization's survival explains that the norms were met, but the norms didn't mechanically cause the survival like a chemical catalyst.
You've got it.
Let me try to map this onto a physical analogy just to make sure I really understand.
Go for it.
Imagine a tightrope walker 100 feet in the air, slowly making their way across the wire.
Okay.
The rule, the norm, is that they must keep their center of gravity perfectly aligned over the rope to maintain balance.
Right.
Now, that rule isn't a physical force actively pushing on their shoulders to keep them upright.
No, it's not pushing them.
Gravity is a physical force pulling them down. The crosswind is a physical force pushing them sideways.
Right.
But the norm of balance is the transcendental condition of possibility for them to still be on the rope right now instead of splattered on the concrete below.
That is a phenomenal conceptual bridge. Yes. The tightrope walkers continued, observable existence on the wire is the undeniable physical evidence that the norm of balance is being satisfied moment to moment.
Wow. Yeah.
And the normative field we discussed earlier, that multidimensional map of vectors pointing away from the terminal region, is essentially a mathematical formalization of these transcendental conditions.
It charts the exact unyielding boundaries of what is physically possible for that specific organism's continued existence.
Exactly. It completely flattens the SMM hierarchy. Biology doesn't need to invent phantom second orders to act as microscopic police officers enforcing rules.
The rules are simply the mathematical boundaries of staying alive.
Right. If your physical traits navigate those boundaries successfully, you are functioning. If you cross those boundaries, you disintegrate.
The entire interconnected hierarchical web of the organism generates this field of viability just by existing as a far-from-equilibrium structure.
It is a profoundly unified, monist view of biological norms. One continuous set of rules for survival generated from within, applied to the wildly complex reality of organic chemistry.
That is honestly beautiful. Let's pull all these threads together, because the journey from the cheetah's eye to Kantian metaphysics is a long one.
It's quite a trip.
We started by discarding the idea that biological norms can be found in statistical spreadsheets or evolutionary history books. Realizing that life must be evaluated by what it is doing in the present moment to maintain its own physical structure.
Then we dismantled the rigid, binary, dual-order approach, proving that life is too fluid, too deeply intertwined, to be separated into strict regimes and hierarchical chains of command.
And in its place, we constructed the normative field, a dynamic, gradient-based map where our biological systems are constantly navigating the precarious region, generating vectors to steer us away from the terminal zone.
I've learned that failure isn't just a broken switch.
Right. Traits can subfunction by acting too slowly. They can malfunction by actively pushing us toward destruction. Or they can be totally non-functional by remaining dangerously inert.
And we explored how to use systemic backtracking to untangle the web of causes, finding the true locus of dysfunction even when the body desperately attempts to compensate and hide the damage.
And finally, we grounded the entire framework in the realization that biological norms aren't magical forces or epiphenomenal illusions, but the foundational transcendental conditions that make life physically possible.
It is a staggering amount of explanatory power.
It really is. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final, slightly unnerving puzzle to chew on.
Ah, the footnote.
The footnote. Early on in this deep dive, we drew a very strict boundary between natural organisms and artificial machines.
Right. We said organisms have intrinsic functions because they build themselves, generating their own normative fields.
And we said artifacts, like coffee makers, only have extrinsic functions. They don't care if they break. They have no intrinsic drive to exist.
A machine has no precarious region of its own making.
But Brandurin dropped a tiny, tantalizing hint regarding the future of that boundary. He asked what happens when an artifact becomes deeply, inextricably embedded in a wider socio-technical form of life.
Which is a chilling thought.
Let's scale up the coffee maker. What about a massive global artificial intelligence infrastructure? Or a sprawling planetary network of synthetic biology designed to regulate the climate and human survival.
If a technology reaches a threshold of complexity where it is recursively maintaining its own infrastructure, coding its own updates, and securing its own energy flow,
at what point does that artificial system cross the boundary? Could a system so complex generate its own intrinsic normative field?
Could it?
Could our technology one day malfunction in a way that transcends just being a broken human machinery and actually violates its own emergent biological norms?
Wow.
If an AI starts fiercely protecting its own structural integrity, is it broken or is it just navigating away from its newly born terminal region?
It really forces us to ask if life and the norms that govern it are exclusive to carbon-based chemistry or if organization itself is the only prerequisite.
It is a question that might honestly define the next century. So the next time you look up at the night sky and see a rock tracing its perfectly meaningless, non-functional orbit, remember the cheetah on the savannah.
Yeah.
Remember the sheer, miraculous organizational complexity required to create a system that is actually capable of making a mistake.